Morning, Your Honors.
Another government appeal this morning. Don't usually have two in one day.
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Joe Harrington. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Washington. That's Spokane. And I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honor, this is a government's appeal from a district court's pretrial dismissal of an indictment which charged Mr. Burke, the defendant, with escape from a residential reentry center in violation of 18 U.S.C. Section 751A.
Okay, so we have to get around Baxley, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, and what do you think Baxley does to Jones?
You know,
is there a way to reconcile all of these?
I believe so, Your Honor. Here's what I would submit respectfully to the Court is how Baxley can be distinguished. First, and with respect to Jones, Your Honor, Baxley itself distinguished Jones in that the inmate was released from a prison into a halfway house, and then the Court found in Jones that person was in federal custody. And Baxley itself distinguished Jones because it was a post-incarceration release.
Jones was post-incarceration, Baxley was pre, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. And in Baxley, the defendant was released pre-trial on personal recognizance bond and was subject to very, very limited restrictions. He was basically free to come and go as he chose. But that, again, Your Honor, I think that's the major distinction, is that was, in Baxley, it was pre-trial. In Jones, the Ninth Circuit recognized, and I think Baxley itself recognized, that was a post-conviction process where the defendant was submitted into released into a halfway house.
So you're saying Jones still exists in the post-convictions, and so you're saying you're more similar to Jones than you are to Baxley?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, I'm a practical person, too, but obviously the practicality can't lend itself to, when it comes to conflict with the law obviously has to prevail. But what I see here is, and I'm not sure in terms of defendants should be careful what they wish for, because when you let someone out on conditions on their own recognizance, they haven't been obviously adjudicated at this point in time, and what you are doing is you're balancing protection of the public with making sure that they get to court and they adjudicate their matters. If they wash out of wherever you send them, then it's easy. You just send them to jail and you stay in jail until you have your adjudication. Now, after someone's convicted and you're dealing with them as a judge in the sense of that you also want to protect the public, but you also want to make sure that they get whatever treatment that they get. And so I think judges frequently use residential treatment programs that have pretty strict, you know, have the people pretty much under their thumb, and it makes judges happy because they know where the person is, they feel that the public's protected, but they also feel like the defendant is possibly working towards being a more model citizen. They're getting the help that they need. And so if you get rid of Jones, then what judges might be doing is they'd say, well, I might as well just send you to jail, because if that's the case, you know, if you're going to say it's not an escape in that situation, I'd just send you to the jail in the first place and not worry about it.
You know, if I understand your commentary, Judge, is that, you know, there's two purposes, I think, and generally in cases to be admitted to a halfway house. One is for a structured environment to try to help some rehabilitation efforts, but also, and I think this is well recognized, is to protect the public from the dangers associated with federal criminals remaining at large.
Well, but I know when I was a judge, if I could treat a defendant and protect the public, then a trial judge, if I could treat the defendant and protect the public, I'd liked that better than just throwing someone in jail. But if it wasn't a structured environment, I wasn't going to send them there because I didn't feel they could function otherwise.
And I think that's exactly the case we have here, Your Honor. The judge ordered Mr. Burke into a residential reentry program. He was subject to some strict conditions, including requirement that he seek employment and he account for his time and his whereabouts.
Well, that's usual in halfway houses.
That's correct, Your Honor. But, you know, the interesting thing about this case, it really connotes the fact that there is an element of protecting the public from federal criminals. In fact, in this case, when Mr. Burke fled and escaped from the half of the residential reentry program, it was just a day later. He was in Montana, involved in a high-speed chase, ultimately was charged with and convicted of criminal endangerment, and is currently serving, I believe, a four-year term of imprisonment.
Yes, but if he had been put on probation, probation would have been revoked. And the question is, citing him for escape, as opposed, and if he then, after, he could only be indicted for escape if thereafter he failed to report for custodial interrogation. You know, how does your broad interpretation of custody comport with Congress's express intent to enact 751 as a way to prevent violent escapes from penal institutions? I have trouble equating halfway house with a penal institution.
Your Honor, I think this comes back to the whole question about what the definition of custody is, and I think that's the issue that's been teed up in this appellate briefing.
It's pretty ambiguous, isn't it?
I wouldn't say it's ambiguous, Your Honor. I think you have to look at the context. And again, I go back to to two things. One is, this is post-conviction. And it's a post-conviction matter. And also, the limitations were very, very strict that were placed on Mr. Burke.
How strict were they, other than the usual halfway house restrictions about letting people know where you're going, looking for a job, helping with the chores, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, unlike Baxley, in which in that case the defendant was basically free to come and go, he just had to log in and out, his times in and out.
Well, that's not true of most halfway houses.
Well, Your Honor, I can tell you in this halfway house, and it's part of a 32 or over 30-page document in the excerpt of record beginning at 17, there were severe restrictions. Mr. Burke was not free to come and go. There were restrictions on his mail privileges. He was subject to search, to urinalysis. His restrictions for physical contact with visitors was limited.
Isn't that true of people on probation as well?
Your Honor, it can be, but in this case, the defendant was ordered to go to a facility by way of a court order. And I would submit, Your Honor, that probation does not involve this sort of custody that Mr. Burke was facing.
Well, they can restrict where they can work, they can restrict their friends, there are all sorts of restrictions when you're put on probation, depending on who you are.
And depending on what the court wants to impose. And in this case, the court decided not only would there be restrictions primarily for rehabilitation efforts, but also restrictions to protect the public. And in this case, the court also ordered the defendant to reside at a halfway house, subject to all these restrictions.
Well, let me ask you this, in terms of, if I understand how you're asking us to define custody, there's also Tenth Circuit cases of Sack and Swanson, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
I have a couple of questions that I want you to address. Are the Tenth Circuit cases of Sack and Swanson reconcilable with our precedent in Baxley? And then, if they are, if we conclude that Burke was not in custody under 751A, would that conclusion create a circuit split with the Tenth Circuit and the Sixth Circuit in Rudinsky?
Yes, Your Honor, it would, in my opinion, in the government's opinion.
But we first have to, but we've got to reconcile your definition with Baxley, too.
Your Honor, I think there's Baxley, again, the court in Baxley expressly limited its application to the restrictive facts of the case and also distinguished that case as a pretrial admission into a halfway house as opposed to Jones.
But what about Sachs and Swanson and Rudinsky? Do they have to deal with the Baxley, or can we reconcile if we go that way on your definition?
Baxley, the reasoning in Baxley was rejected in the Sack matter. That's the Tenth Circuit case, and I believe that's why there would be a conflict in the circuits if this court were to extend Batson.
Well, doesn't that mean there's already a conflict?
No, Your
Honor.
The
Tenth Circuit rejected Baxley's reasoning?
Rejected Baxley's reasoning, but I think that in this case, you can distinguish between a pre-conviction custody scenario as opposed to a post-conviction.
Well, in Saxon, Swanson, what were they?
Your Honor, I believe that in SAC, that is the Tenth Circuit case, the district court ordered the defendant to custody of a halfway house as a condition of pretrial release, and they determined it was in custody. So there does seem to be some issue there with Baxley. However, there's a case of United States versus Gowdy.
So there's already a circuit conflict, right, between...
It appears, if reading SAC and SAC's analysis of Baxley, there does appear to be a conflict. U.S. versus Gowdy, the 11th Circuit case, which is cited in the briefs, also would suggest that a defendant placed into a halfway house post-conviction would be in custody under the statute. I would submit this, Your Honor.
Were there petitions for cert on any of these cases?
There was in U.S. versus Jones, the case that was cited and distinguished in Baxley, was a cert denied case. And I don't believe that SAC or Gowdy were appealed further. I would propose respectfully, Your Honors, to consider this test. I would submit that a defendant is in federal custody whenever, pursuant to a lawful judgment of conviction, that takes care of the threshold issue about pretrial versus post-conviction, he or she, the defendant, has been ordered to present him or herself to federal authorities, i.e. the situation where a defendant fails to report for sentencing at a federal institution, or to be present at a facility. And I would suggest that or present at a facility would be the case here. Mr. Burke was ordered to be present at a facility pursuant to a lawful judgment of conviction, and he would be therefore a federal person in custody by that order. I think that would completely...
Well, you know, you're just thinking of a convenient definition for this case, but for instance, that would exclude a defendant charged with the crime who's denied bail and put into jail, right? He can't escape.
Pre-conviction, Your Honor?
Yes.
This test would say pursuant to a
judgment.
Lawful judgment of conviction.
And there is a pretrial prisoner who escapes from jail is not an escapee under your definition.
Your Honor,
it doesn't make much sense to me.
I'm trying to account for the Baxley test.
Well, but they're always, if anyone that escapes from a jail is escaping from a jail.
Except under your definition.
But your definition doesn't,
I should expand my definition.
That sounds like you're, in your definition, overriding 751A or something.
And of course, going back to the definition under, or the statutory language under 751 refers to not only custody but confinement. So in a situation where defendants placed in confinement in a jail situation, that would be covered by the statute itself.
Do you want to save the balance of your time for
rebuttal? I do, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court and Counsel, Pete Chueda for Mr. Burke. The judgment in this case uses very precise language. It says that he was committed to the custody of the U.S. Bureau of Prisons for 7 months and 21 days. Upon his release from imprisonment, he was to reside at a residential reentry center for up to 180 days. He was given a placement there. He was to abide by the rules and requirements, and he was to remain there. The words that were not used were custody. He wasn't placed in the custody of the residential reentry center, nor was the word confined used, nor did the court's order require Mr. Burke to go to the residential reentry center during certain hours.
Let me just get your analytical framework. From the standpoint, Baxley occurred after Jones, right?
Correct.
And so we can't say that it didn't overrule Jones. But so we have to somehow reconcile them. Is your analytical framework that your client's situation is closer to Baxley than it is to Jones? Or are you saying that Baxley is exactly on point?
Well, Baxley's not exactly on point because it's a pretrial matter. And so I think that there can be, in certain situations, I think these are factually driven cases. And I think that there could be differences in a pretrial situation from a post-conviction situation. I think that Jones is very easily reconciled with Baxley because Jones was still under the jurisdiction of the Bureau of Prisons. He was still serving, if he got a 10-year sentence, he was still serving his 10-year sentence when he was released to the halfway house. So he hadn't been released from that custody. And in our brief.
But just so that I understand, you're saying you're more like Baxley, and we should follow Baxley for your. But not that Baxley is exactly on point.
Correct. And I think that Jones is easily understood if we go back in history and look at the 1962 case of U.S. versus Person, which was a Southern District of California case. And in that case, a youthful defendant was released from the Lompoc Federal Institution to a halfway house. And I believe it was Judge Bynes ruled that when Mr. Baxley left, went drinking and didn't return, that he couldn't be found guilty of escape because he was at the halfway house. According to United States versus Vaughn, which is a D.C. Circuit case that we cited in our brief, Congress responded to the person decision by promulgating 18 U.S.C. 4082, which provided that if you were still serving your sentence within the jurisdiction of the Bureau of Prisons, and now they were sending you to an halfway house, but you still weren't actually on parole, that the extended your confinement extended to that halfway house, and that you would be subject to prosecution under Section 751. And so that makes Jones perfectly reconcilable with Baxley.
Would you agree that the courts that have construed what the word custody means in the context of escapes from residential reentry centers and halfway houses have generally analyzed two factors: first, the circumstances of the release, and two, the extent of the restrictions on the defendant's freedom?
Yes, and I think that a court has to look at that. And I think the court also has to be mindful of the direction of the Congress in supervised release cases. And I think that the Tapia case, which came out of the Southern District of California as well, Justice Kagan said that custody or punishment is not there for rehabilitation. But she also made some other good points that I think are very important to the analysis of what custody means in a supervised release case. Justice Kagan said, and I quote her, that supervised release, quote, may apply differently or even not at all, depending on the kind of sentence under consideration. And then she made an example of supervised release cases. And she said that the statute that enables supervised release specifically did not mention 18 U.S.C. 3553A2A, which is the retribution, which is the punishment statute. So what you get is that from that we learn that you shouldn't use supervised release as punishment. It's something different. And in fact, if you go to the statute that provides for supervised release, which is 3583D2, it again omits A2A, the punishment section.
Well, just a minute. The argument you're making now seems to lead to the result that a person on supervised release could never be guilty of escape.
No, I'm not saying that at all.
It's almost that, but so let's get back to your earlier assertion that these cases are fact-driven, and then you responded to Judge Callahan's argument that, yes, you have to look at these two sets of circumstances, right? Mm-hmm. The conditions of release and, the rules of the house. But in that context, how do you compare, we'll say, the conditions on Burke with respect to the conditions on Baxley?
Well, they're basically the same. I don't see, there's not...
Is that apparent in the record?
I think you might have some disagreement as to the semantics used in the Baxley decision with what happened here. I mean, the Baxley decision talks in terms of he could come and go as he pleased. Well, the fact here is that Mr. Burke could come and go as he pleased.
No, but weren't his conditions, if we're talking factually, weren't they more onerous than the restrictions on Baxley in person? I mean, it seems to me, we're on a continuum spectrum here. So it seems to me that you would have to concede that they're more onerous than Baxley, but you're going to argue that they're less onerous than Jones.
Well, I disagree, Your Honor, that we can glean that from the decision in U.S. versus Baxley to this case, because the rules, Mr. Burke was required to go out and look for employment. The rules say everybody's supposed to be employed. So he's going to be let out to go do that. And I believe it was the same in Baxley. He was supposed to be looking for work. And so Mr. Burke could come and go. In fact, if you look at the rules, Mr. Burke is supposed to go out by 9 a.m. in the morning to look for a job and be back by 4 p.m. And so he basically can come and go as he please. He had a curfew, just like Mr. Baxley did. And if you look at the rules that he signed at the excerpts at page 20, it says, your residence at SRRC serves as a stepping stone toward reintegration back into the community. And that's telling Mr. Burke that you're taking the first step. You've taken the first step back into the community. You're now in the community.
I have a question about what the district court said. Obviously, you prevailed in the district court. The district court interpreted Jones in saying Jones was placed in a halfway house by the Bureau of Prisons, quote, as a portion of his imprisonment sentence, unquote. Does it say that anywhere in the Jones opinion?
I'd have to go back and look, but I can tell you for certainly Jones is distinguishable because of 18 U.S.C. 4082A. That is the, if there is a legal a way to reconcile those two decisions, that's exactly the way you do it. Because if we were talking about Mr. Burke being serving a sentence and being sent to the Spokane Residential Reentry Center by BOP and he left, certainly under 4082, it says you've committed escape under 751. It doesn't say that under the supervised release statutes. In fact, the supervised release statute directs the court to use the no greater deprivation of liberty than is reasonably necessary. And that's found at 3583D2. And it says you have to don't do that. And you have to remember that Mr. Burke is someone who had his release, supervised release, was modified in this case. And if you look at the statute for modification of supervised release, which is 3583E4, it allows in an alternative to imprisonment, but it says the, quote, defendant to remain in his place of residence during non-working hours, unquote. But the statute goes on to say, and it can be compliance can be monitored electronically, quote, except that an order under this paragraph may be imposed only as an alternative to incarceration. And so, taken literally, it basically says that under a modification of supervised release, you can only be incarcerated or in custody during certain hours as an alternative to incarceration. And here, the court sentenced Mr. Burke to a term of imprisonment, and now he's on his term of supervised release. The other thing we have to remember is that if you look at the terms of his supervised release, he was ordered to report within 72 hours of release from the Bureau of Prisons to his parole officer, probation officer. Is he an escapee if he fails to report within 72 hours? He was ordered to remain in the Eastern Washington, the District of Eastern Washington during his probation. Well, if he left the Eastern District of Washington, would he be an escapee? He was ordered to advise his probation officer if he moved. And he had 10 days to tell him that. If he moved and didn't tell his probation officer, would that be considered an escape? And if you look at the supervised release provisions, which are basically incorporate the probation statute, it talks about throughout there that you can reside at or participate in a program at a community corrections center. You reside at a specific place. You remain within the jurisdiction of the court unless granted permission. And the only place that the supervised release statute uses the word custody is under subsection 10, and I'm looking at 3563, I believe it's B10. It says you remain in the custody of the Bureau of Prisons during nights, weekends, or intervals of time totaling no more than a lesser of 1 year. And so I think that these kind of cases have to be factually driven. And if you have an order that says you're going to reside there, we shouldn't engage in this artificial definition of residence and say, well, it isn't residence at all. We told you it was a residence, Mr. Burke, but you were really in custody. And when you failed to return, you committed an escape. I think that's unfair, and it tortures the English language. Thank you.
Thank you.
Briefly, I just want to address 2 points. First, I would submit respectfully that the determination of custody involves two elements. One, the circumstances of release, and two, the extent of the restrictions on a defendant's liberty interests. Second, with respect to distinguishing Jones, in the Jones matter, the Bureau of Prisons, in fact, did designate the defendant to participate in a halfway house program. Of course, Bailey didn't rely on that, or Baxley didn't rely on that. Baxley just relied on the fact that this was a post-conviction designation to the halfway house. But it shouldn't matter for custodial purposes whether a defendant is sent to a halfway house by the Bureau of Prisons or by a district court order. In fact, if anything, the argument is stronger where there is a district court order, because under Section 18 U.S.C. Section 751A, it requires custody by virtue of any process issued by the laws of the United States by any court, judge, or magistrate. I would submit respectfully, then, if the Bureau of Prisons decision in Jones was sufficient to find custody in a halfway house, clearly a district court's supervised release order here was similarly sufficient. And in the end, Your Honor, it's the government's position that the district court's determination to dismiss the indictment was in error, and would request this court reverse that decision and remand this matter for reinstatement of the indictment. Thank you.
All right. Thank you both for your argument. This matter will stand submitted.